Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
He is the man behind the words of some of the most famous and beloved musicals of the last 60 years, writing for everyone from Elton John to Madonna and creating unforgettable songs just like these.
Don't cry for me, Argentina. The truth is I never left you all through my wild days.
Can you give in the circle of life?
Jesus, I started to believe the things they say of you.
That is, of course, composer Sir Tim Rice, who joins us now to talk about his illustrious career. Tim Rice, you are very welcome to the show.
Well, it's very kind of you, Dervil. I'm delighted to be here.
And I know you're going to be coming to Dublin in April at the National Concert Hall for My Life in Musicals. I know him so well. And I feel as if I know you quite well because I've been listening to your wonderful podcast, Get On To My Cloud. But it's wonderful because you have been sharing your craft and your own story with your listeners. And this new show that will be coming to Dublin, it's looking, and Belfast, it's looking at the stories behind the songs and your lyrics. And is that where all of your lyrics begin? Or what is the magic nature of, how does a song come together?
Well, it varies. It depends in a great way how the composer likes to work, because I'm just a words man. I've written the odd tune, but you know, nothing that anybody would know. And it has to be a team thing. So some composers like to have a tune and then get me to put lyrics to it. Others, like Elton John, famously, like to have lyrics, and then they will put a tune inspired, we hope, by the words. So that varies. And of course, there is a difference between writing songs for a musical, which are often dramatic, as it were, sung conversations between people, not necessarily straightforward songs, although straightforward songs are a very important part of musicals, whereas a pop song or a one-off record really has to be something that is fairly instant and has to obey different sorts of rules. But mainly I've worked with fairly dramatic situations or musical situations, both in theatre and film. And I prefer that. I think I'm much better at that than I am at writing just regular pop songs. I find it rather hard when writing, if a composer, however brilliant he or she may be, I find it quite difficult to write just a song out of the blue, because I need to feel as a character, I need to know the situation of the person, of the character's life or problems or whatever.
The big, big dilemma that
exactly
unfolds. Tell me this, did writing come naturally to you? I know that both of your parents were good writers, so was that something that was sort of in the genes?
Well, I guess it must have been, because my brother Joe is a successful writer as well. He's got lots of cricket books to his credit. He's had about 30 or 40 books out in his life, not all on sport, but on various topics. And I think we do take after our parents. My mother was a very good writer. She didn't really, in my opinion, quite fulfill her great potential. She wrote lots of short stories, which were published in magazines. She did lots of broadcasts from the BBC. She wrote articles for humorous magazines like Punch. She also wrote for The Times. And when she was 80, some 30 years ago, her wartime diaries were published and were very successful. And they were amazingly well written. I mean, she was only 19 when they started. And her descendants, of whom I am proudly one, were all very thrilled to see her being recognized that late in her life. And she was delighted to suddenly earn a few extra bob from something she'd written when she was a young girl. But she was very talented. My father was a very good writer, but he didn't really do very much at all. He wrote one or two articles here and there. He basically was a businessman, mainly in the aviation business, but he traveled a lot and had a very sort of great interest in history and geography. So I guess that's where Joe and I got our abilities.
And Tim, what was Christmas like then in your house growing up with all of those brilliant minds and wit and stories and words?
There wasn't much wit running around at Christmas time, I don't think. We were just an ordinary family, really. I used to write funny poems when I was very young. You know, both my brothers did. And we always enjoyed playing with words. We weren't a particularly, well, my parents were not that musical, strangely. They enjoyed music and they had a record player, which they didn't buy until, you know, sometime after they were married. So we weren't sort of brought up with music in the house all the time. But we, in the end, when we were teenagers, we brought music into the house. And obviously we brought in Elvis and Cliff and the Shadows and people like that.
And you also introduced the world to the aardvarks, even if people haven't quite remembered. Yes, and that was your school band. What I love is the fact that your journey to failed pop stardom that set you off on a different path in life. Were you hopeful that you would become a pop star rather than a lyricist?
Well, I had a sort of, I mean, to be honest, I don't think I ever seriously took the view that I had a chance of being a pop star. But I did make one or two demo records because I enjoyed singing in my pop group at school. I mean, I wasn't a particularly good singer, but I found I could imitate pop records quite well. And somehow by imitating various singers, American or British of the day, it sort of made me sing better in tune. I didn't concentrate so much on singing in tune. I concentrated on putting over the song and almost by mistake found myself singing in tune. And when I left school, aged 18, it was a fairly posh minor public school, you were all expected to do something fairly respectable, mainly go to university, which I didn't really want to do. So I went into the law, which was a mistake because I was hopeless at the law. And wasn't really interested in it. But while I was being hopeless in the law, I was writing songs, not to sell the songs, but to sell myself as a singer. And one of the songs, well, the tape of three songs was sent round to various record companies who showed no real interest whatsoever, certainly not in me. But one of the record companies rang me up and said, "Who wrote the songs?" And I said, "Well, actually, it was me." And I said, "What do you think of the singer?" And they said, "Not much." So the music publisher said, "Well, we like the songs. We don't want the singer." And I said, "Well, that's fine. I mean, we've got rid of him." I said, "You know, he's no longer in our band," although it was me. and one of the songs got recorded. And it wasn't a hit, but it was actually recorded by a group. And I didn't know the group. It was just done because they liked it and their producer liked it.
It's sort of so fascinating, this idea of you as a sort of young sort of legal trainee wanting to do that, and you stumble upon this kind of career's words. But as in many things in life, there's a chance encounter or an introduction to another person that really sets you on a completely different path. How did you meet Andrew Lloyd Webber, and what age were you both when you first met?
Well, it came about partly because of my one song, which was released, and I was using that as a sort of calling card. And I also had one or two ideas for books. I didn't know what I was doing. I just thought I'd end up as a really boring, unsuccessful lawyer. But meantime, I was pushing book ideas, music ideas. And I went to a book publisher about an idea for a book, and he didn't like it. But he said, "What else do you do?" And I said, "Well, I write songs." And I played him my one song that had come out. And he said, "I don't like that either. But I do have somebody who might like to meet you, young lad who I'm sort of representing. This is a book publisher called Andrew Lloyd Webber." And I thought, well, he'll have to change his name if he ever wants to make it. Anyway, Desmond Elliott, the publisher, put me in touch with Andrew, and I went round to see him. This is way before phones and portable phones or emails or anything like that. So I wrote him a letter and got a call back from him and went round to see him. And he was absolutely obsessed with musicals. And I didn't know too much about musicals apart from my parents' album collection. So I knew the scores of some musicals and I always liked them, but I'd never seen a musical apart from My Fair Lady once. And I was much more into rock and roll and pop. And the Beatles were just broken through and the Stones were around and I loved all that best. But Andrew convinced me that very quickly how talented he was by playing a few tunes. And they reminded me of Lionel Bart and Richard Rodgers. These are great, great composers. And he said, "Would you like to write some words? You know, because I've got this musical ready to go." And I said, "Fine." And I did. And that one didn't work. But when we had been together for about 6 months or a year, we were invited to write for a school by a schoolmaster who'd heard our efforts, which hadn't got us anywhere, but he liked what we'd done. So he said, "Why don't you write something for our school?" And we began writing Joseph, and that was the beginning of something that really worked.
Obviously, that eventually gained incredible traction. But you on went on then together to write Jesus Christ Superstar, which must have been quite, you know, genre-defying at that time, and probably where you brought your rock and roll culture to the fore.
Yes, I think it was. It was funny because we didn't really think we were breaking incredible new ground or anything, but we were, because we were turned down by all the theatrical establishment. Nobody wanted to do the show, which we'd written, Jesus Christ Superstar. But we got a record company interested, and they were very keen to do it. And of course, this gave us, and Andrew in particular, gave us the opportunity to work with big forces like a rock band and an orchestra and a choir, all these things which we could never have done as unknowns in the theatre back in 1969. And we were therefore able to make it genuinely rock, but also genuinely operatic, genuinely a musical. And we did kind of break ground there. I mean, The Who had done Tommy about the same time, which was great, but it was a rock band, really. I mean, that was what it really was. It was a rock band doing a fantastic Pete Townsend work, and wasn't quite the same as what we were trying to do with Superstar, which was more theatre-influenced.
Yet it became this huge cultural juggernaut, one of three that you wrote with Andrew, and also addressing issues like, I mean, Eva Peron, like Evita. Do you think the world would have much cognizance of her were it not for the musical? Can you claim some credit for how you elevated her story?
Well, yes, I claim lots of credit. I mean, everybody told us when we wrote Superstar, the theatre people told us before we got the record out, they said, well, it'll never work because everybody knows the story. When we said we were going to do a show about Eva Peron, by which time we were established, we were known, everybody said, well, that won't work because nobody knows the story. And I thought, well, hang on, that's exactly the opposite of what people said about Superstar. So the point is that both were great stories and both worked.
And controversial stories, Tim, in the sense of, you know, in a world of cancel culture or all of those things that artists might feel a bit reluctant or perhaps hesitant to tackle religion, you know, to tackle big controversial figures, Judas, Pontius Pilate, then moving on to more modern, you know, political issues such as Eva Peron. Did that interest you? Was there a sort of a sense of activism, or was it just the characters?
It was the characters, it was the story. I wasn't interested in even a message in a way. I mean, I always feel that musicals should never preach. I don't think plays should preach too much either. I think the key to making something work is that you tell a great story. And if there are messages, and if the story is well told, then those messages will get through. And sometimes people can take different messages from the same show, or the same piece, or the same book. It's, I think, a mistake by and large for people to come out and say, I'm writing this musical and it's all about this cause I strongly believe in. No, I think you should write something which tells a story about people who are affected by events and let the punters make up their own mind. That's a bit of an oversimplification, but I think that's what we did with Superstar. I just wanted to tell a story, a great story, in a new way musically and in from the point of view of Judas Iscariot, which wasn't something that most people had ever thought about telling it that way.
Did you and Andrew ever doubt that you would break through, or are you still staggered by the success you've both had, both individually as artists, but also working together?
Yes, I think if you said to me back in 1965 when we met, this is, you know, 60 years later, you'll be still chatting about Jesus Christ Superstar and all the other things you've done, I would have thought that was somewhat unlikely. But I think Andrew was always convinced he was going to be successful. I don't mean that in any nasty way. He was just very driven. I was really in it for the ride, if you like. And I thought I was quite good at what I was doing, but I never thought it would be successful. I thought, well, other people are successful, not me.
You did three hits together, and people always still in their minds have that picture of the two of you working together. Was it, to deploy another phrase from the modern era, was it a conscious uncoupling, or was there any frisson?
Well, there was a bit of frisson, but the main reason was that Andrew wanted to do Cats after Evita, which, you know, was very successful, but it didn't need lyrics because he was setting the poems of T.S. Eliot to music. And there was no job for me. So that meant we went our separate ways. And actually, I quite enjoyed working with other people. It was good. And I don't think we would have done anything. I mean, Andrew did, you know, very successful stuff like Phantom of the Opera, which actually it's a brilliant show, but as a topic, wouldn't have been one that particularly interested me.
So how do you define success, Tim Rice? You know, because you've had these amazing collaborations, you've had big, big hits with Disney, like Lion King and others, which are, you know, commercial successes and are being toured still all over the world. But I know you have a huge fondness for Chess, which would be the favourite musical of many people, but perhaps maybe didn't enjoy that same commercial prowess. What do you define as a success for you?
Well, I think Chess, as it happens, has been a success. Certainly, it's been more successful than 95% of musicals, but not more successful, like Superstar and Evita, than 99% of musicals. Chess is, funnily enough, scheduled to come back to Broadway late 2025. We've been putting it together for the last couple of years.
Do you feel it didn't get the recognition that it deserved at the time? You seem very,
well,
very...
On Broadway, it was an absolute disaster first time round because we got it wrong. And we had a lot of bad luck. And it's a complex story. The records were very successful, the songs. And so many people come up to me and say, oh, I think Chess is my favourite musical. And I always think, well, they probably mean that because it's so much easier to say, oh, I like Jesus Christ Superstar or Lion King because everybody knows those. But a lot of people know Chess. But in America, where the show has not yet been a mega hit, people still seem to like it. And Bjorn and Benny are as good as anyone I've worked with.
What is it? What's the secret of a hit? When do you know it's going to be a hit?
Well, you don't really know it's going to be a hit until it's come out and is, you know, people are going to see it or people are buying the record. You really don't know. I mean, it's just so difficult to predict. I mean, we thought that the record of Jesus Christ Superstar would be, if it was going to be a hit anywhere, would be a hit in England because we were around to promote it and we were British. But it wasn't, not to begin with. It took off in America like a rocket, and that was really unexpected. So you just don't know until it's actually out there. And Superstar was very successful in almost every country but Great Britain, and, you know, for about a year. And then when eventually the show came to London, that turned it round in the United Kingdom and indeed in Ireland. But, you're kind of in the lap of the gods. You just don't know who's going to go for something. I've certainly put out one or two songs occasionally from shows, which were perfectly good songs, but the record just didn't take off. And there's a lot of luck involved in it as well. And also what's out at the time, because if you think about it, in the days when the charts mattered, and they don't really matter so much now, but in the days when, you know, the whole record business was desperately tuned in every Tuesday morning or whenever it was to see what was in the new number one, there were only room for 40 records in the top 40, and there were a lot more than 40 records being released. And some of the ones that weren't hits, obviously, were pretty good. So you just don't know.
I remember when I first learned about your collaboration with Disney, thinking, God, that's a bit of a plot twist. I sort of didn't see that collaboration in my mind. But I have to admit that your name was cursed in my house for many years because our young sister was addicted to the song A Whole New World.
Oh, well, that was with Alan Menken.
Which was played non-stop in our house.
Thank you.
You went on to do some amazing works and work with Elton John, for example, on Lion King. How did that collaboration come about?
Well, I was working with Disney. I met the guys at Disney in about 1990, and they were talking about doing the movie of Evita at the time, and it never quite happened. Although I think Disney had an involvement in the movie in the end. But I met a lot of the Disney executives and the people running the company. And I said, you know, in passing, not knowing whether Evita would happen with them, I said, look, I love your animated films. I love your cartoons. I grew up on them. And they've just been hitting the big time again with the cartoons after a very quiet period. They came back with Little Mermaid and they were working on Beauty and the Beast. And these were big hits in the tradition of Snow White and Bambi and Dumbo and all those other great, great films. And they were thinking of expanding their animation division. And I said, well, if we're looking for someone to write words, you know, I wouldn't mind having a go. And after a while, they did offer me something. They said, we've got this wacky idea about a film about a lion cub whose wicked uncle murders his father. And I went to the very first meeting about that, and there were about three people there, including me. And a picture of one lion on the wall, And that eventually became The Lion King. And Elton John came into it because once we
knew...
You
brought him into it, didn't you?
I did, really, yes. Once we knew that the show was going to... the film was going to happen, or at least was... people are going to try and definitely make it happen, and we needed someone to write music, I suggested Elton John. And I said, I don't think you'll get him. But they got him. And Elton's always been very generous. He's often said to me, really, I owe the fact that I've got another career to me. And I think, well, you know, fair enough, Elton, but you earned it yourself by brilliant songs.
What was he like to work with? Because I know he has a reputation as being quite exacting.
I would say he was the easiest composer to work with of all the composers I've worked with, because for starters, he hardly ever queried a single lyric. That may not be a plus in a way, because but he just seemed to genuinely like all the lyrics he got. He asked me at one point for one more line of something in Circle of Life. But basically he just did very quickly. He wrote a wonderful tune to the lyrics I gave him. And that was really quite speedy, and it was great fun for me to do it that way around, because apart from the old scene here and there in one or two of the shows, I'd never really written lyrics before the tune.
What's the worst lyric you've ever written? What's the one you're most ashamed of?
I'm not desperately ashamed of any of the hits. There are one or two, I think, the odd line here and there. If there's not a perfect rhyme, I get rather annoyed with myself. I keep trying to... In Joseph, there were one or two, because we never dreamt Joseph would be anything other than a school concert. And so there were one or two lines in Joseph that I wanted to change when it became a professional show, because I thought, well, that doesn't really rhyme. But they said, no, you can't change that line. It's our favourite line. Things like, you know, go, Joseph, you're doing fine. You and your dream go ahead of your time. That's a very bad rhyme and frankly, a pretty boring couplet. But I said, no, you've got to change that, you know, go, Joseph, you're doing fine, you know, hang on now, Joseph, it's all divine or something. I mean, I hadn't really got around to it, but they said, no, you can't change it. You can't change it. And rhymes like district and biscuit, which are not actually a pure rhyme.
But sometimes Tim Rice needs must. Tell me, what's really interesting is that many of us grew up, you know, taking part in or attending, and in a lot of cases, the school musical versions of many of your works. And I know you get invited a lot to attend school performances. Do you still get enjoyment out of that?
Oh, yes. Joseph in particular. I think I enjoy going to a school performance of Joseph often more than a professional one. I mean, some of the professional ones, like, you know, with Jason Donovan or Donny Osmond, have been absolutely magnificent. And it always works. I mean, I can't recall ever seeing people walking out of Joseph. But there's something about seeing it done by an enthusiastic group of kids, often as young as 6 or 7. And it just works. And that's great, because that's what it was written for. And it's always nice to hear youngsters. And maybe, you know, some of them will think, oh, I might go into this theatre business.
And just on that point about going into the theatre business, from what we've heard, there's a lot of rejection in this world. So you needed to be very persistent. But when you look at the more modern phenomena of, you know, jukebox musicals, what do you think of those? And what is your, I don't know, what do you think about the possibility of young composers and artists breaking through? Because it's these big titles, these big works that have dominated for the last 40 or 50 years.
Yes, it is interesting that musicals, or it's a fact, that musicals go on for much longer, which in a way means it's harder to get a new musical on, although something great like Six, which has, you know, been a recent big hit, will always break through. But it's, I mean, the advice I would give to anybody would be, don't, as I think I said before, don't preach, don't feel you have to have a message, don't try and change the world, just tell a great story in a new way, and that's the only advice you can give. And obviously, like in any art form, you know, be it books, painting, sculpture, acting, whatever, sad to say, not many people are going to be successful. And you need, obviously, you need a bit of talent, but a lot of people with talent don't make it, or don't make it in a big way. And you need an awful lot of luck. And sometimes somebody with not much talent has a lot of luck. There are no hard rules. But I do have a sort of list of my 10 golden rules for how to write a hit musical. I'm not sure I can remember them now. But
look, I mean, you have an incredible backlog of unused songs, which I'd love to sit and listen to them and go through them. Have you any plans to bring those forward? Or is there anyone you haven't collaborated with who you'd say, I'd love to go work with them?
Well, not desperately. I mean, I've been very lucky. And I've written with a lot of great rock composers like Rick Wakeman. And I even wrote a couple of songs with Freddie Mercury. And that's great. I've always enjoyed that. But I think the first thing, even if you said, right, I'm going to write, you know, a new musical with, I don't know, Dua Lipa, just a snatch.
Which would be a fantastic collaboration.
Well, I'm not sure it would. I don't think she'd be that keen. But that's not the first thing that matters. The first thing that matters is the idea, the story. I mean, if I had a brilliant idea for a musical, then it would be a question of which person could do the most suitable job. It wouldn't necessarily be the most talented or the most successful. It'd be somebody who would empathise, if that's the word, with the idea.
That sounds like something of an open call to anyone out there who is tempted. Really, really appreciate you joining us today. The title of your show is Sir Tim Rice, My Life in Musicals. I know him so well. I think we know you a little bit better by now, but those who wish to can go to the National Concert Hall on April 23rd to see you and to hear you talk about your extraordinary life. And for more information, go to nch.ie. But for now, Sir Tim Rice, thank you so, so much for joining us. And we wish you and your family a very happy new year.
And the same to you, Derval. Thank you very much. I'm looking forward greatly to coming to Dublin and having the singers and the band support my chat.